This is Scott Stevens, and you're welcome to the Jesus Factor here on this cold Sunday afternoon. Stay tuned. We've got an update on what's going on with Israel. There's a lot happening, and from around the world. Well, yes, sir. This is Scott Stevens, and I'm glad you were able to join me today here on the Jesus Factor. I'm hoping that the system is working. I have a new microphone engaged here, and there's a story about the microphone. It's not a pretty story, but it's one that is worth talking about here for a moment. And it is frighteningly cold here in East Hampton, Connecticut. I'm a little surprised, as it was quite pleasant yesterday and the day before. And while it's bright, it is windy and brisk and wintry here in Middle Connecticut. And I really want to apologize for not bringing a broadcast last week. I procrastinated about getting a microphone for some time, and it may have even been months that I've known that my microphone was on the fritz. And each week I would battle to get the old mic up and working, sometimes without much trouble and other times with a whole lot of frustration. And the truth is, my priorities were wrong. As soon as the mic got working, I forgot all about it until the next broadcast. And rather than making this assignment, the faithful broadcasting of the Jesus Factor, important, I allowed the cares of the world to take priority over and eclipse the importance of my service to God. And as so many of the ministers on the network today have said, when we allow the world to take first place and operate out of an evil heart, that is to say a carnal heart and mind, and we do this every time that we don't choose the fear of the Lord. It is, after all, by the fear of the Lord that we depart from such evils as this and become part of his body, putting on the mind of Christ, as is our appropriate service. And this was a little thing, right, this microphone, but in the end, the scripture says, who is faithful in least will be faithful in that which is great. And I often foul up in greater ways because I don't care enough about what the Lord might think about what I'm doing. I don't make it my priority. And when I went to buy this microphone, the first thing I thought about was to look at the price. I thought about how much money it was going to cost. And I began to compare the microphones that were available based on price. And somehow I remembered that I wasn't there to save money. I was there to serve the Lord. And so, thankfully, in this instance, I caught myself. And I put the thought of the cost out of the way, and I asked, well, Lord, which one should I buy? And this is just one way that we decide to place him first, and it is a demonstration of how it is a decision and not a feeling or some other nebulous thing, but a decision to place God in the center. And the message earlier today of how Jesus was always about the Father's business and the many reminders of how we must learn to suffer the loss of all things and to count them as dung so that we might receive and walk in the righteousness of God. The opportunity to do this over and over again so that we ultimately get it right is in fact present with us all the time. Each day and in every moment we have opportunity to glorify God, and it all begins with the decision to both fear and love the Lord with everything we have. Those are the rough and tumble guitar licks of Alvin Lee and 10 Years After, I'd Love to Change the World, but I don't know what to do. That was, of course, the refrain of the 1960s. We have warned here on the Jesus Factor that the circumstances revolving around and evolving from the Iranian nuclear ambitions are in many ways similar to the types of things that were going on in the world in the 30s and 40s with regard to Hitler's Germany. What has happened in the last week is astounding. The first preliminary nuclear deal that six world powers, that is U.S., Russia, China, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, signed with Iran before dawn today, at the end of a four-day marathon, failed to address the most questionable aspects of Iran's nuclear program. These are its clandestine military dimensions. The accord confined itself to aspects of uranium enrichment and stockpiles. UN inspections were expanded, but not applied, for instance, to Iran's concealed nuclear sites, or even the Parchin military base, where Iran is suspected of having tested nuclear-related explosions. These explosions, by the way, are the types of explosions geared to imploding uranium, enriched uranium. For those out there who don't know how this works, in order to create a bomb such as the one we dropped on Japan, those two particular weapons were of the implosive variety. You have to have a charge set in such a way that it creates an impact around a central sphere or shape of uranium, enriched uranium, U-235 at least. And that charge has to go off in such a way that it creates impact from every direction. This research has been going on in Iran for some time, but it is not considered in the discussions that led up to the agreement that has been forged here in the last 24 hours, sadly. Netanyahu, of course, Israel's prime minister, characterized the agreement signed with Iran early Sunday morning as an historic mistake, directly contrasting U.S. President Barack Obama, who praised the agreement as opening a, quote, new path toward a world that is more secure. Netanyahu, speaking at the weekly cabinet meeting, said the world has become more dangerous as a result. What was agreed last night in Geneva is not a historic agreement. It is a historic mistake, Netanyahu said. Today, the world has become much more dangerous because the most dangerous regime in the world took a significant step to getting the most dangerous weapon in the world. For the first time, he said, the leading powers of the world agreed to uranium enrichment in Iran while removing sanctions that it has taken years to build up in exchange for cosmetic Iranian concessions that are possible to do away with in a matter of weeks. Netanyahu said the consequences of this deal threaten many countries, including Israel. He reiterated what he has said in the past, that Israel is not obligated by the agreement. Iran is committed to Israel's destruction, he said, and Israel has the right and obligation to defend itself by itself against any threat. He went on to say, I want to make clear as the Prime Minister of Israel, Israel will not allow Iran to develop a military nuclear capability. Netanyahu's government denounced world powers' nuclear agreement with Iran on Sunday as a bad deal to which Israel would not be bound. Yet Israeli officials stopped short of threatening unilateral military action that could further isolate the Jewish state and imperil its bedrock alliance with Washington, saying more time was needed to assess the agreement. We here at the Jesus Factor are a little confused by the wording bedrock alliance. Unless there's something going on behind the scenes, a bedrock alliance is not characterized by an agreement made with an arch enemy of a dear friend. Netanyahu's sentiments were echoed by Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, who called the deal a historic mistake and a surrender to the Iranian charm and smiles offensive and to Iranian fraud, which is aimed at gaining time without the Iranian nuclear program being substantially armed. Once again, here on the Jesus Factor, speaking of these things for some 18 months now, as we warned from the very beginning, we are dealing with a regime that is subtle, sophisticated, understands how to manipulate the media, and is gaining friends and influence all around the world. Not the least on the list are the Russians and the North Koreans. Speaking from Canada, where he is attending a conference of defense ministers, Yalom said the agreement allows Iran to enter the family of nations, despite being the most active and flourishing activator of terrorism in the world, which sends its deadly and uncurbed deadly arms across the globe, first and foremost against Western states, as regime representatives sit at the table in Geneva. The Iranian nuclear program threatens not only Israel and other Middle Eastern countries, but also world peace, Yalom warned. To leave in the regime's hands capabilities for continuing the nuclear program means that the world today is a much less safe place. Instead of rolling the program back, the regime in Tehran has gained time, which will allow it, on the one hand, to seek a nuclear bomb, and on the other, breathing space due to the lightening of sanctions. The defense minister continues. And hours before the deal was signed, the regime in Tehran was facing heavy economic pressure that threatened its existence and which could have forced it to choose between survival and continuing the program. But now, due to the short-term considerations and a lack of determination by the West, again, something we've spoken of here innumerable times in the last 6 or 7 months, the Iranian regime is receiving legitimacy for continuing the military nuclear project and its global terrorist activities while its international isolation is lifted and its economy is strengthened. Aimed at ending a dangerous standoff, the agreement between Iran and the United States, France, Germany, Britain, China, and Russia was nailed down after more than 4 days of negotiations in the Swiss city of Geneva. But the deal still appeared to fall short of Netanyahu's demand for a total rollback of the Iranian nuclear program. You stand and shout out until you're blue in the face, and you try to understand why they're not listening. The world wanted an agreement, Finance Minister Yair Lapid, a member of Netanyahu's security cabinet, told Israel's Army Radio. We also said that a diplomatic accord would be good. A diplomatic accord is certainly better than war. A diplomatic accord is better than a situation of permanent confrontation. Just not this agreement. All this coming from high-powered officials in Israel. President Shimon Peres said that the deal was temporary, not permanent, and would be better discussed after seeing its results. Like all nations, we prefer a diplomatic solution over any other solution, Peres said. I turn to the Iranian people and say, we are not your enemies, and you do not have to be our enemies. We have never threatened you, so why are you threatening us? Peres urged the Iranians to choose peace and to turn Iran into a responsible nation that is not involved in terror and is not a nuclear threat. Economic Minister Naftali Bennett, another security cabinet member, told Army Radio in a separate interview, quote, Israel does not see itself as bound by this very bad agreement that has been signed. Neither Lapid nor Bennett would be drawn in on how Israel might respond. Israel, which is widely assumed to have the Middle East's sole atomic arsenal, sees a mortal menace in a nuclear-armed Iran and has at times threatened to launch a preemptive war against its arch foe. Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman said the Geneva deal required the Netanyahu government to conduct a strategic review. Asked on Israeli radio whether he felt cheated by the United States for its role in the deal, Lieberman said, and I quote, "Heaven forbid." Meretz chairwoman Zahava Galon on Sunday praised the agreement while criticizing the Israeli government for overlooking important components of the deal. The Israeli government minister's assault on the agreement takes attention away from the fact that clauses of the deal include the most important goal, which was the dismantling and rolling back of the fast track to the bomb. We've spoken a number of times about the Arak reactor in Iran. They have suffered some serious damage in the midst of the construction project there, going through the various testing protocols that are necessary to bring a reactor online. And that reactor, once up and running, would certainly have augmented their capacity to manufacture weapons-grade uranium. As it turns out, this agreement essentially gives them time to bring that reactor up to speed, to repair the damage, and to figure out what exactly went wrong in their manufacturing process. Those that favor in Israel this particular agreement, such as Meretz, say that the main sanctions that will remain imposed on Iran and the tight supervision by the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, who will visit nuclear sites daily, are indicative of the fact that this is not just an American achievement, but also an Israeli achievement. So clearly you have division between the some of the political elements in Israel. There are those who believe you can negotiate with Iran, even in Israel. And I think that all of us, in considering the path that Iran has been on for some number of years, the support for its hateful rhetoric towards the United States, towards Israel, towards other Western nations, suggests that for this nation to achieve a nuclear capability would present a serious threat to the United States and our allies. The idea that more and more time being given to Iran is a good thing seems wrong-headed to this broadcaster. And I'm sure everyone has their own opinions in these matters. But I must say, this is the kind of arrangement that allowed Hitler to march most of the way across Europe before the United States as a nation recognized the threat that he posed. The Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Likud M.K. Moshe Feiglin, said on Saturday the interim agreement signed between Iran and the Western powers was tantamount to the Munich Agreement of the late 1930s. Like Czechoslovakia at that time, which was not party to the discussions that effectively sentenced it to death, Israel today watches from the sidelines how its existential interest is being sacrificed by the Western powers. What this says is that there are political elements in Israel that recognize the pattern, the ongoing pattern, that is obvious to those who carry the Spirit of God in this building mess in the Middle East, one that precludes some type of Antichrist figure coming to the fore and bringing destruction, bloodshed, and misery to the people of God. Feiglin called on the Israeli government to declare an immediate end to all contacts with the West over the Iranian question and to make it clear that it would not be bound by the agreement signed. That, after all, has happened. Knesset member Eli Yashai reacted Sunday morning to the deal, and he said the world's countries only saw the economic interest of the deal and not their obligation to the security of Israel. He stressed that Israel has no one to trust besides God and themselves. Speaker of the Knesset, Yuli Edelstein, said today, more than ever, we have been reminded that we can only rely on ourselves. He said it would not be long before the world powers who signed the deal with Iran will realize they had made a mistake. And here at the Jesus Factor, we're not sure how long, but we agree. The time will come when this agreement will be recognized as abject folly.
It's okay.
is easy. A little Jethro Tull there to lighten up the moment. There are a number of things about this particular agreement that should give reasonable people pause. We have several of them here to speak of. Parchin, the long-suspected facility remains out of UN oversight. President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry boasted after the signing of the agreement that daily international atomic energy inspections will take place at Fordo and Natanz. However, cameras are already fixed at both these facilities without an agreement, whereas Tehran's consistent denial of IAEA access to Parchin is not addressed. Secret nuclear locations. Under the heading Possible Military Dimensions, the last International Atomic Energy Agency report noted that since 2002, the agency has become increasingly concerned about the possible existence in Iran of undisclosed nuclear-related organizations, including activities related to the development of a payload for a missile. Dirty bombs. Iran doesn't need a full-scale nuclear bomb or missile warhead for attacking Israel. For decades, Tehran has been working on perfecting hundreds of dirty bombs as part of its nuclear program by adding plutonium or enriched uranium to conventional bombs. These weapons are easy to make and easy to use. In the hands of Hezbollah or other Shiite terrorist organizations in Syria or Iraq, for instance, they could be used to strike Israel without leaving a trail to Tehran. Rollback. While President Obama has presented the deal as a first step toward freezing or even rolling back key aspects of Iran's nuclear program, the fact remains that so long as Iran is permitted to enrich uranium, even though this is restricted to a low 5% grade, it is free to produce as much fissile material as it wants, whenever it wants. This is a roll forward, not a roll back. Enrichment. Obama and Kerry said the New Deal does not recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium. They were contradicted by the Iranian president and senior negotiator, as well as Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. So what is the truth? If Iran won recognition for this right, it blows the bottom out of the non-proliferating treaty because, in no time, all the signatories may start enriching uranium with permission from the big powers. Neither is there any point in making Iran join the NPT's additional protocol for snap inspections. Centrifuges. Iran has undertaken not to add new centrifuges to its enrichment facilities, according to President Obama, but there is nothing to stop them from keeping the ones they have in production. In the six-month interregnum for negotiating a comprehensive nuclear deal, Tehran wins time to turn out enough centrifuges to substantially expand its production of enriched uranium. A leap to breakout. Far from being static or in freeze, as the Americans claim, Iran is free to step up centrifuge production and boost its stock of 3.5% enriched uranium, thereby accumulating enough material to enhance its capacity for producing enough weapons-grade uranium to break through to a nuclear bomb rapidly enough to defy detection by the International Atomic Energy Agency or Western Intelligence until it is too late. These are just a handful of the loopholes in this treaty. Now, there are a number of people here in the United States that did not agree with either the ideology or the technological aspect of this treaty. Many in Congress thought it was a bad idea to begin with. Congress expressed bipartisan concern Sunday, today, about the deal with the United States and their allies reached overnight with Iran to halt the country's nuclear program. Bob Corker from Tennessee said, and I quote, "My greatest concerns are seeing follow-through. This administration is very big on announcements and less so on following through. Iran is spiking the ball in the end zone." He also repeatedly said that he didn't want the interim deal to become the norm. Corker was joined on a broadcast on a major network by Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat of Maryland, also a member of the Chamber's Foreign Relations Committee, and he said, "We are very concerned as to whether Iran will live up to these agreements." Cardin said that Congress needs to be prepared, meaning that the idea that treaty violations might become the rule rather than the exception in Iran. Obama, speaking from the White House while Secretary of State John Kerry helped ink the agreement in Geneva, called it a first step toward a comprehensive solution. The problem with Mr. Obama is that he, if he is a true believer, and he may be, if he is a true believer that you can negotiate even with your most fierce declared enemies and come to a place of safety and security through those negotiations, if he honestly believes that, and he may be a true believer, he has given up much in demonstration of his faith. The idea that Mr. Obama could be something of a Manchurian candidate has been spoken of in a number of far-right wing circles, and the idea that this could be one more in a series of blows against the United States disguised as curative measures, essentially the Obamacare of foreign policy, is not far-fetched. And there was a time where, in my own contemplation of all of this in prayer and in careful consideration, I found it hard to imagine that there could be a true Manchurian candidate in the White House. But as we continue to see how Mr. Obama has operated, the only two possibilities are that he is a true believer, although deluded in his thoughts, or that his intention is either to destroy or remake the United States into something other than its original intent. When contrasting those two possibilities, we find ourselves in the unfortunate place of beginning to think that perhaps, just perhaps, Mr. Obama is operating with the intent of the destruction of the country. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida said that the agreement makes a nuclear Iran more, not less likely, and called the deal a blow to our allies in a region who are already concerned about America's commitment to their security. And it sends the wrong message to the Iranian people, who continue to suffer under the repressive rule of their leaders, who have only their own self-preservation in mind. Rubio, a rather clear thinker from down there in Florida. Obama insisted the sanctions relief is reversible if Iran doesn't live up to its end of the bargain. The broader architecture of the sanctions will remain in place, and we will continue to enforce them vigorously, said Obama, who urged Congress not to pass new sanctions against Iran in the light of the agreement, saying doing so would derail this promising first step and alienate us from our allies and risk unraveling the coalition that enabled our sanctions to be enforced in the first place. Measured against what is happening and against the words of our president, one can only wonder. Under the terms of the agreement, which concluded days of negotiations in Geneva, Iran committed to halt enrichment above a 5% threshold and to dismantle the technical connections required to enrich uranium above that threshold. Iran is also required to neutralize its stockpile of near 20% enriched uranium and halt progress on its enrichment capacity. In return, the six world powers, the United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, those are the usual suspects, have agreed to not impose any new sanctions, suspend sanctions on certain sectors of Iran's economy, and potentially unfreeze $4.2 billion in revenue from oil sales if Iran meets other conditions. The White House said in a statement Iran's nuclear program will be subject to increased transparency and intrusive monitoring. And again, we've already spoken about that. They've only agreed to allow monitoring where monitoring has already been allowed. There are no new concessions in this agreement. Speaking from the White House late Saturday night, Obama said that the terms of the deal were substantial limitations which will help prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Simply put, they cut off Iran's most likely paths to a bomb. And again, there is grave suspicion and significant evidence from the intelligence quarters in Israel that Iran has operated and continues to operate under the radar of the International Atomic Energy Agency's antenna facilities that are moving toward some type of nuclear device. Iran President Hassan Rouhani endorsed the agreement in a nationally broadcast speech Sunday, saying the accord recognizes Iran's nuclear rights, even if that precise language was kept from the final document because of Western resistance. No matter what interpretations are given, said Rouhani, Iran's right to enrichment has been recognized. He later posed with family members of nuclear scientists who happened to have been assassinated by spies in Iran over the past years. And then he said, trust is a two-way street. And he insisted that talks on a comprehensive agreement should start immediately. Now, what a lot of people don't realize, and perhaps hasn't been widely circulated in the national media here in the United States, is that the reason this agreement has emerged so rapidly on the international stage is because there were secret negotiations going on with Iran for some time. The United States and Iran have been secretly engaged in a series of high-level face-to-face talks over the past year and a high-stakes diplomatic gamble by the Obama administration that paved the way for the deal sealed early Sunday in Geneva aimed at slowing Tehran's nuclear program. This, an Associated Press story. The discussions were kept hidden even from America's closest friends, including its negotiating partners and Israel, until 2 months ago. And that may explain how the nuclear accord appeared to come together so quickly after years of stalemate and fierce hostility between Iran and the West. But the secrecy of the talks may also explain some of the tensions between the United States and France, which earlier this month, just last week, that is, balked at a proposed deal, and with Israel, which is furious about the agreement, and has angrily denounced the diplomatic outreach to Tehran. President Barack Obama personally authorized the talks as part of his effort, promised in his first inaugural address, to reach out to a country the State Department designates as the world's most active sponsor of terrorism. What you have here is a megalomaniac president who thinks he can negotiate with a country that is hell-bent on destroying us and our allies. This man has an unbelievably inflated image of himself. If he is a true believer, the idea that he can, above every other person in the world, make a deal with a nation that has sworn that its entire operation is geared towards the killing, the destruction of Israel, the killing of the Jewish people, and the destruction of the United States and other Western powers. The idea that Obama, in and of himself, is able to negotiate a peace with these people says that if he is a true believer and he is not a Manchurian candidate, that he has at the very least a Messiah complex. He can bring peace to a world where there is no peace. Insanity, at least. The last four of these clandestine meetings were held since Iran's reform-minded president, Hassan Rouhani. And remember, we've done a number of detailed broadcasts about the power structure in that country. Make no mistake about it, it is the Ayatollahs, the religious ministers that run things in Iran. It is the Revolutionary Guard that controls the military in Iran. And it is Hezbollah that is the only true international outreach of the country of Iran. This agreement was produced after secret negotiations, and all of the ones who've revealed all this have spoken on condition of anonymity, this once again from the AP report, because they were not authorized to discuss by name this highly sensitive diplomatic effort. The AP was tipped off to the first U.S.-Iranian meeting in March, last March night of 2013, shortly after it occurred. But the White House and the State Department disputed elements of the account, and the AP could not confirm the meeting. The AP learned of further indications of secret diplomacy in the fall and pressed the White House and other officials further. As the Geneva talks appeared to be reaching their conclusion, senior administration officials confirmed to the AP the details of the extensive outreach, all done in secret, without the knowledge of the American people or the international community. All to set the stage for Obama to appear as some form of Messiah, megalomaniacal Messiah. Astounding. Simply astounding. And this, by the way, these reports, by the way, all available online, this AP report, extraordinarily detailed in this in its focus on this series of secret negotiations that went on. And in the meanwhile, the Temple Mount, of course, the rapture crowd always worked up about the Temple Mount and its potential for being rebuilt. Apparently, many of the supporters of the rapture crowd believe that a reconstructed temple is essential for the emergence of Antichrist. There is serious debate in the political institutions of Israel as to whether or not they might change the current situation with the mount. For many years, a fringe group of ultra-religious Jews have pushed for greater Jewish access to Jerusalem's Temple Mount, one of the world's most contested religious sites. But now the campaign is moving up the Israeli political agenda. At one of the world's most contested sites, Max Friesden puts his finger to his lips, gesturing for silence before easing into a faint, defiant smile for the camera. They're not allowed to pray over there, by the way. The Jews, should they go into the Temple Mount, are forbidden from praying. Under long-standing rules, non-Muslims can only enter the site, which is home to the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, for a few hours, 5 days a week. Israeli police officials escorting small groups of Jews warn them that they're not permitted to pray as they pass to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. No singing, dancing, bowing down, or even moving their lips in prayer. The site is the symbolic heart of the contesting territorial claims of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and disturbances in this space, revered by Muslims and Jews, can have serious implications. In 2000, a controversial visit to the complex by Ariel Sharon, then a candidate for prime minister, helped spark what would come to be known as the Second Palestinian Intifada. The Temple Mount was captured by the Israeli military in 1967, but returned to the control of the Muslim Endowment, or the WAQF, that has been the site's guardian for centuries. While the access rules have helped maintain a fragile peace, a fringe group of ultra-religious Jews has been defying the constraints on Jewish access to the site for decades. These days, as hardliners have increased their political power in Israel, the issue has turned into a topic of public debate and has even moved up to the Knesset. Earlier this week, extraordinary scenes erupted at Knesset Committee for the Interior when Arab-Israeli lawmakers objected to some of their fellow parliamentarians' demands for Jewish visitation rights at the Temple Mount. And, of course, there's talk of the Second Intifada in all of this. But the idea that many of these people believe that a third Jewish temple should be built on the site where Jews believe the first and second temples stood about 2,000 years ago. He explains that all the plans are in place for this controversial project. At a time when things are shaking and quaking around the world, whatever one might make of all of this, the rapture crowd certainly believes that a temple, a Jewish temple, needs to be in place on this site before the Lord's return. Bit of fire on the mountain here for you for a minute. yes, it's been a great blessing to be here with you today. And, as crazy as things have gotten here in the world, in a time where things seem to be just coming apart, it's easy to remember that Jesus is Lord. Put Him first and foremost, and then everything falls in place. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. May the Lord bless you all. We look forward to seeing you next weekend, Thanksgiving weekend, here on the Jesus Factor.
Red as a beast.